Good morning. Next case on our calendar today is A23. You can be seated. Thank you. Is A23-10194, Lagoon Partners LLC versus Silver Cinemas Acquisition Company, doing business as Landmark Theaters. For those of you who weren't in the courtroom earlier when I mentioned this, we are now live streaming our oral arguments, which we are very excited about. So you'll see some new technology in the courtroom. The OWL cameras, I think, are in front of the bench. And we are still doing an audio recording of our oral arguments. That will be available on our website, usually within 24 hours. No other recordings of our oral arguments are permitted, either in the courtroom or on by those watching the live stream, without the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We will get started here in just a minute. Council will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock on the podium. The podium is also adjustable, so feel free to adjust that. And also, counsel, if you can please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument, we would greatly appreciate that. So we can proceed when counsel for appellant is ready.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Eric Hansen, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Silver Cinemas Acquisition Company. The case before your honors is a commercial lease case, and the central issue is whether or not the acceleration clause contained in that lease is an impermissible penalty under Minnesota law. I intend to address that issue first. Hopefully, if there's time, I'd like to address issue as to whether or not there was a genuine issue of material fact, as to whether or not there was mitigation by the landlord. And the third issue is whether or not the district court abused its discretion under Rule 5604 in not deferring its decision on summary judgment, because there was clearly discovery going to that mitigation issue. To begin with the lease itself, the lease provision in question here is 20B4. It's at the addendum, page 5. The court can take a look at it. Reads ultimately an aggregate sum, which at the time of such termination of this lease represents an amount equal to the present value of the net rent, an additional rent payable for the unexpired balance of the initial term or any renewal term. Cut some language out, has to do with net present value. But in other words, what this lease purports in its acceleration clause is if it is terminated or breached, that however long the lease was to run, that then becomes additional rent that is owed. And Minnesota case law on this is fairly clear that this sort of provision is a penalty clause. And this area of law really overlaps with the liquidated damages.
There's no appellate court case in Minnesota discussing acceleration clause without mitigation, is there?
Without mitigation? To my knowledge, there is not. There is not a, I do not believe there is, if I'm understanding your question, I don't believe there is a Minnesota decision that is upheld an acceleration clause without there being a mitigation component.
Well, in fact, is there any Minnesota appellate court case on acceleration clause for a breach of a lease?
I believe the Lariat Baja Soul one, unpublished decision that was cited by both parties. I think that was a breach of lease. I focused respectfully on there was a pretty, I think, material difference in that lease agreement, in that one clearly had a provision that said we're going to take into effect take into account the landlord's ability to mitigate its damages. Okay. And so I think that's really crucial.
It just strikes me that a lease and a loss of rents is different than normal kinds of damages for a breach of contract.
I believe so, in no small part because of the predictability that we have from rents.
You know what the monthly or annual lease is going to be, and you can calculate it.
That is exactly it. That I completely agree. Liquidated damages provisions have been upheld by this court in past, but when you read those are fact-specific driven decisions, and when they have been upheld, part of the discussion is it's really hard to tell how we're going to calculate what that number should have been if this contract had been performed. And in those cases, the court will say, well, parties bargained for this, so we're going to enforce that. But I think that is very key that you can look to the future and say, what's this number? Here, whether this was breached on day one, year 14, that's a mathematical equation, varying perhaps slightly by CAM charges. That's about it. Otherwise, we know what the rent was from beginning to end. Draw a line, the lease will tell you this is how much is owed this month, and so on into the future. And unlike the Lariat case, this provision had no possibility of considering any kind of mitigation. And I think that that reality really goes to why this is a penalty.
Well, you say there was no consideration of mitigation, but there is language discounting the amount at a rate of 7%
right.
per annum.
That's
is there any evidence in the record regarding what the purpose of that discount was, whether it was for mitigation purposes or to reflect the time value of money?
There's nothing in the record. I will note that the language of the provision itself refers to the present net value as being the basis for the deduction. And I would respectfully submit that if that wasn't there, on that basis alone, it would have been a further evidence of an unenforceable penalty, because you're talking about getting money, in this case, 6 years into that you wouldn't have earned for another 6 years, getting it today. I think our jurisprudence is pretty clear that there is a deduction for the present net value of it. That's what this provision focused on. Respectfully, I think the district court just missed this one. The lease itself does say present net value, but there's certainly nothing in the record pro or against that's, the present net value deduction is in lieu of mitigation or anything like that. There's nothing like that in the record.
Mr. Hansen, do I understand your brief correctly to say you have three main brief points in your brief, and is your second argument in the alternative to the first?
It is, yes, that we believe that this is an unenforceable provision. Let me amend my statement, Judge. Yes, we believe it's unenforceable. We also believe that Minnesota law generally stands for the idea that mitigation, whether it's expressed in the lease or not, is allowed. So whether you find that this was an unenforceable penalty or not, I believe that the case law says and imposes an outside duty beyond the lease on the landlord to mitigate damages. And so in theory, I guess you could say, well, this isn't an unenforceable penalty clause. Obviously, I disagree with that conclusion. But you would still have to address this issue of mitigation. And there was clear evidence of mitigation. And to the extent that the court finds that it wasn't clear, then that really tips over into our 5604 argument, which is if the evidence is unclear, obviously I think it is clear, if it is unclear, it's because they stonewalled us on discovery. And we made that point really crystal clear to the district court. And respectfully, as I read the district court's decision, I think basically the district court's conclusion was that mitigation didn't matter. And I think that is a misreading of Minnesota law.
So would you agree with me? So as I was reading the case law, it seems to me that the determination of whether such a clause is enforceable is a fairly fact-dependent question. Seems like the case law often considers the facts and circumstances of each case in some detail before making the determination about whether it's enforceable or not. Would you agree with that?
Respectfully, I'm not sure I would. I think there's kind of a paucity of decisions in this area of Minnesota, and ultimately that's why we cited some of the cases from other jurisdictions. And specifically, I'd like to direct the court to the Cummings property decision.
Before you do that, I want to learn more about Minnesota case law. I mean, which Minnesota case, in your view, makes a determination about enforceability or unenforceability without respect to the evidence in the case?
I would say none of them are completely in the absence of evidence of the case. But I don't believe that we have the analytics of that quite worked out like you see in other jurisdictions. And if I may, that's what the Cummings decision, I think, is really relevant for this court's thinking around how is this to be done. And what that case says is the court's going to look at the question of was the penalty enforceable at the time that the contract was made? Or was it a penalty, more accurately, at the time the contract was made? So
let me stop you there, because I know Cummings said that at the time the contract was made. Is that part of Minnesota case law?
It is not. Respectfully, I don't think that there is guidance in Minnesota case law as to whether or not this is a totality of the circumstances, or, like I said, Massachusetts addresses it by focusing at the initiation of the contract.
They say that expressly. And again, I guess my observation of the Minnesota case law is that Minnesota appellate courts, the Supreme Court, typically looks at the facts as they exist at the time of the dispute, after the breach has occurred. It seems like most of the discussion about what the facts relevant to whether or not the clause is enforceable or unenforceable are facts that exist at the time of the litigation. Would you agree with that or not?
I think I would agree with that as a general proposition, but I don't really think that the point that you're getting to has been grappled with by any of the cases cited by the parties. I don't think that there's been a reasoned conclusion by any of our appellate courts that, nope, we're going to look at it from the time of the breach versus at the time that the contract was formed. Either way, I just don't think that analysis exists that I've read in Minnesota law. There's hints and pieces of it. One of the cases cited by the landlord here was the matter of the estate of Hoffbeck. And in addition to being a reasonably old case, you read that one, and to me, the conclusion that you really get from it is where the court ultimately gets to, fundamentally, we think the district court made a mistake, and therefore we're going to step in. And there isn't an analysis as to, not a very reasoned analysis, as we're going to look at it at the start of the contract versus at the time of the breach and the relative values there. So a long way of answering, I don't think that it's as fleshed out as it should be, would respectfully be my answer.
On the issue of the enforceability or unenforceability of a liquidated damages clause, what does the law say? What does the case law say about who has the burden on that issue?
I believe it is typically the person challenging the liquidated damages provision.
What's your authority for that?
(Clears throat) Yeesh, I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not sure I have the case site to that. I'm going on recollection.
Understood. Okay.
Apologize.
Thank you.
Ultimately, I think, you know, the liquidated damages case law is relevant and informs this, but I think, as Judge Klopach noted, this is a different area of law. What we have here is not some unknowable number in the future. And as I read our liquidated damages precedent, the ones that are upheld really go to this question: can we tell what the number should be? And therefore, it's more a question of the courts giving deference to the parties to make that decision.
Well, you emphasize the duty to mitigate in your mitigate the damage.
Yes.
And that's taken account generally in calculating damages for a breach of a lease.
It is supposed to be, yes.
In absence of a provision like this, anyway. So in terms of calculating the damages, is it really, it's easy to calculate the amount of rent that hasn't been paid, but is it easy to calculate the mitigation piece? That's what I'm not, I think you argued in your brief it's relatively easy to calculate, but I'm not clear on that. How is that done?
Well, so I'll use this specific example. Obviously, we benefit from hindsight. It is a performing arts venue today, and it is not 2026. It is being used for something else today. Was that in front of the district court? It wasn't. But was there evidence that it was being transformed? Yes. I believe that that's a question that ultimately goes to the fact finder, and the fact finder gets the evidence about whether or not they leased it, whether or not they made attempts to lease it, or whether or not they set about, in this case, in a conversion. And that factual inquiry allows the district court to draw a line beyond which it says, we're not going to award you this additional damage because that amounts to a double recovery. Save the balance of my remarks for rebuttal, please.
Attorneys for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Brian Nimchek. I am joined by my colleague, Ryan Tice, and my client's representative, Ned Abdul, in the courtroom today. I represent Lagoon Partners, LLC, the commercial landlord for the space which once housed Uptown Theaters. And I'd like to start my remarks, if I could, with a brief quote from District Court Judge Karen Janisch, who heard and decided the case below. She said the following during the summary judgment hearing: acceleration clauses are something this court regularly sees, and not necessarily only in lease provisions. She goes on to say that they see it in loans, in mortgages, in a whole bunch of other contexts, and then says, I would imagine that if the acceleration of the amount that otherwise would have been payable, would it be a settled issue under Minnesota law? And Judge Janisch had it right. This is a liquidated damages provision that can be analyzed under the existing case law, the century worth of precedent that has been developed on the question of when liquidated damages provisions are enforceable and when they are a penalty. And applying those factors and that case law to this situation, and looking at the relatively few cases that do address acceleration clauses, like Lariat, this provision is an unremarkable, a standard, a clause that the court should see no reason, based on the undisputed facts, of disturbing.
So one of the criteria in the case law is whether the harm caused by the breach is capable or incapable of accurate estimation, and that's been stated in different ways, whether, you know, the amount can be determined.
Correct.
And why is that not true here, given the fact that the lease agreement specifically spells out the lease payments for every year of the lease?
Sure. Because of the uncertainty of future events. It'd be one thing if the damages were knowable, calculable, understandable at the time of the breach. But here we have a breach and then 5 more years during which my client was supposed to have received a stream of income of several million dollars from a large company that had contracted to pay it that money. Instead, it has an uncertain amount of damages, as the court referred to in previous comments, that will be affected greatly by if and whether it is able to mitigate damages and to what extent, based on both.
So let's take a hypothetical. Let's say that the tenant, Landmark, moved out. Your client simply closed the doors, probably had some of the same costs, maintenance, property taxes, utilities, things like that. But if it just closed the doors for the next 6 years and then could depend upon the rent payments, then it seems like they would have, you know, they would have no, I mean, wouldn't that be an easy calculation?
I would say no, Your Honor. We're still talking about the future value of money.
Well, that's accounted for in the discount value in the lease as well, right?
That would account for the existing value of the lease. But we don't, you know, my client may decide to do that today, and then something happens a year from now, and then something else happens 2 years from now, and then we're hit with a pandemic, and then the building's struck by lightning, and there's an economic collapse. Who knows? That's why the parties, these very sophisticated parties, sat down and agreed that that is uncertain. We need to come up with a way of calculating what those damages might be, to come up with a reasonable prediction of what they might be, and they came up with a number that was discounted to account for future uncertainty, but was a prediction, an estimate of what those damages would be for the remaining term of the lease, which here isn't 15, you know, this breach didn't happen 6 months in, leaving 14 and a half years of uncertainty. This lease was performed on for a decade, breached not trivially, but in a major way, and then leaving about 5-6 years left on the lease, we could go back, we could look at what the parties agreed would be the damages, apply the appropriate discount rate, and come up with a liquidated damages number that bears a relationship to the actual damages, because it is tied to the amount of months left. It's not a scenario where if you breach, we get double of whatever months were left. Those would be situations where courts have stepped in as a matter of consumer protection, as a matter of looking at unreasonable penalties, and made those sorts of provisions unenforceable.
This lease makes no mention of mitigation of damages, which is, as I understood, almost hornbook law in Minnesota as to a commercial lease.
It does not say the word mitigation of damages, correct, Your Honor. It does contain the discount rate, which serves to reduce the potential damages of what they might be by a percent.
How does that equal mitigation of damages?
Well, mitigation of damages would be uncertain. It prevents or it relieves the landlord of the burden that the district court was worried about. That's coming back every year with a new repetitious lawsuit. Okay, it's 2024. Let's see what mitigation damages we had in 23 and come up with a number, and sue for that and recover that, and then come back a year later and do it again.
All the Minnesota law requires is that the landlord do something. Try to rent it out, you know, get what you can, whatever you can to limit the damages that otherwise would occur.
And in this scenario, the landlord has not been sitting on its hands.
In this scenario, in this case, landlord did nothing.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't catch that last.
The record reflects that landlord did nothing in terms of mitigation. Is that right?
The landlord did not have mitigation income at the time the district court made its decision.
Did the landlord make any efforts to obtain mitigation income?
Yes, Your Honor. That is in the record in discovery. My client made clear that at the time of the summary judgment hearing, demolition efforts were underway to redevelop, restructure the property into what it is, ultimately into what it is today, 18 months later.
So that's your claim for mitigation?
That attempts were made, certainly. The landlord wasn't sitting on its hands, but there wasn't any mitigation income yet at the time that it was accelerated, at the time the lawsuit was initiated, and at the time we were all talking to Judge Janosch about whether
and if the landlord made those attempts and with the purpose of trying to reduce the amount of damages, that would be calculable as to what the mitigation was.
Well, the landlord was attempting to redevelop the space. At the same time, there was this, you know, who knows whether that will be successful. A lot of, you know, anything could happen in the future. And so that's why the parties agreed to this, to remove that uncertainty. And the law allows them to do that in a scenario where...
That would be more impressive. In fact, that was mentioned in the lease somewhere.
Is precedent what? Sorry.
I said that would be more impressive argument if somewhere in the lease that concept was mentioned.
In the Lariat case, the court looks at that. That involved an acceleration clause. It dealt with a scenario where there may have or may not have been mitigation income at the time that the summary judgment hearing was held and the judgment was entered. And the court in that case kind of mused about whether it might possibly matter if there was income already at that time, but ultimately entered judgment in the liquidated damages amount because there wasn't enough evidence in the record to show that that income actually existed at that time. But that court didn't rule that, yes, that would matter if there was income at that time or not. It said it might matter. But here we have no income, no mitigation income at that time. It simply hadn't happened yet. And there wouldn't be mitigation income for some time, which, you know, the law doesn't require that the landlord wait for that. That's why these sophisticated parties got together and did this instead.
How do we know if the liquidated damages amount is a reasonable estimate of actual damages if we don't know more about what occurred after February of 2022?
Well, short of simply waiting for years, you never would. You have what you have are two very sophisticated parties getting together and deciding, estimating that it will A, be tied to the number of months left and not like doubled or tripled as we see in some liquidated damages clauses, and that there would be a discount rate applied. So they estimated the damages, the actual damages, as being that number. And I think...
But how do we know if that's a good estimate? I mean, unless we know more about subsequent events. And of course, the appellant asked for a continuance of the motion hearing in order to do more discovery. District court denied that. But is it possible to answer that question, which is part of the legal analysis about enforceability of liquidated damages clauses, without knowing more about subsequent events and how the landlord has reused the property after retaking possession?
Yes, Your Honor, because in cases where the court was questioning that, looking into whether there was a liquidated damages problem, it really would always come back to a consumer protection scenario, where you have the little guy being given a contract by the big guy and being forced into signing a liquidated damages provision that they don't understand, didn't have a role in negotiating in any meaningful way, and are faced with some sort of extreme penalty for a trivial breach. And those aren't our facts at all. Landmark Cinema does not need this court's help to protect it from the consequences of what may now seem to it like a bad deal.
Okay, but I feel like you're not answering my question, which is focused on the requirement in the case law. One of the requirements is that the amount is a reasonable estimate of actual damages. And how do we know that without knowing more about subsequent events after February of 2022?
I understand, Your Honor. And we know that because these parties agreed to it, and these parties are highly sophisticated parties.
Well, but how do we know if it's reasonable? I mean, just because they agreed to it doesn't mean it's reasonable, right? I mean, the case law says courts scrutinize these agreements to determine whether they're reasonable and therefore enforceable. And one of the questions is whether it's a reasonably accurate forecast of actual damages.
Sure. And my initial answer is that these parties are in a position to know. And that's what I'm getting at. And so there, the court should defer.
So they know.
But you're basically saying whatever they agree to makes it reasonable just because they are sophisticated parties?
Well, not whatever. The court could step in when there's some sort of egregious scenario or someone's being taken advantage of. But there's no evidence in the record of that. And the court did in
Isn't
its questions.
Isn't that where the question of mitigation comes in? Because would you agree that we look to the Gorco Construction Company case sets forth the the standard that courts apply to determine whether a liquidated damages clause is enforceable.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last part.
The Gorko construction case, you're familiar with that case?
The which case?
Gorko, G-O-R-C-O.
Yes.
So yes. There's two parts to the test as to whether the liquidated damages clause is enforceable, which Judge Johnson has been going over with you. And the first one is specifically whether the amount so fixed is a reasonable forecast of just compensation for the harm that is caused by the breach. And so the inquiry is whether it's a reasonable forecast of just compensation under that provision.
Absolutely.
And
you're,
and so in looking at a lease situation, isn't mitigation something that needs to be taken into account in terms of whether it's a reasonable forecast of just compensation? Because typically in a lease breach situation, there is a duty to mitigate. So in order for the compensation to be just, shouldn't we consider whether the liquidated damages clause accounts for mitigation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There should be a consideration of whether there's mitigation income or not. That would be part of how, I'm sorry, let me back up. There should be a consideration at the time of the summary judgment and that the court is being asked to enter a judgment on the record before it of whether there's already mitigation damages or mitigation income that might affect the reasonableness of the amount chosen by the parties.
And so what evidence is there in the record to show that that 7% was intended by the parties to be in agreement as to the amount of mitigation that's appropriate for just compensation?
The record tells us that the amount chosen is tied to the amount of years left in the lease. It's not a number picked out of the air.
It's just flat out payments, which would not account for mitigation at all. It seems to me your only hook for mitigation is that 7%.
It's that there was an agreed upon discount rate of 7%. And whether that is an appropriate amount or not, the court should defer to the parties and.
But we don't even know that that was intended to be mitigation on this record, do we?
It simply says that the courts or that the parties are applying a discount rate. And I'll say too, and to finish my thought here with the last seconds I have, I'll say too that the burden is on the other side, on the party challenging it, to say that 7% is way off. The amount we agreed upon is not even close, and here's why. And I know that because I operate theaters. I'm Landmark Cinema. And that's all the time I have, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Could I, Judge Cochran, follow up on that, on the last statement you made? On the issue of burden, I guess, what authority is there for the proposition that the burden is on the other party?
I believe you would find it in the Moywishin case, a court of appeals, and
I would say Mavison. I think that's the way it's
could
spoken
be.
In
M-E-U
St. Paul, at least. But yeah,
W-I-S-S-E-N.
Right. That speaks to burden?
I believe it does, Your Honor, and I'm not 100% sure, but I am certain that the burden is on the party challenging the liquidated damage provision to say that it's not an appropriate amount, and the district court dealt with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think the statements by my opponent ultimately illustrates the issue here. Mitigation did happen, and so what the record is really is we've got an issue of double recovery. That's why these clauses are scrutinized, because there's money being made today as an art performing space. His testimony was that demolition was underway. That would have been in the court record had the court compelled them to answer the discovery that was timely served or deferred on the motion 5604. I believe that evidence was in the record that we have, and I understand that this court is bound by the record that's before the district court, but that evidence of the intent was there to raise a question of genuine material fact such that summary judgment was inappropriate. Under the procedural posture, a motion for summary judgment, the district court had to look at the facts in a light most favorable to the non-moving party. In that case, that was my client, and there was definitely evidence in the record that mitigation was underway, and instead, the court ratified this acceleration clause that effectively said, we're going to make you pay until 2026. That's this case. That's why we have this case law about mitigation of damages, because our rule, our whole premise, is based on this idea that landlord can either take back the premise or can insist on the benefit of the bargain. Can't do both. That's what happened here. There was a question made about what was the evidence of mitigation at the time of summary judgment. And one of the things that I wanted to comment on briefly, simply because it was raised in the dueling briefs, was there was a Star Tribune article relating to what was the intent of this property. And that was introduced to the district court for the first time on appeal. There's a claim made that it's inadmissible and should be not considered by this court. We laid out why it's admissible in our reply brief, but I would also note that that's a Thiel v. Stitch problem. They did not challenge its admissibility at the district court. District court did not rule on that basis. Rather, the district court concluded that the acceleration clause didn't require mitigation, didn't allow mitigation, I guess, more accurately, and that's an error. And ultimately, that's the reason why this court should reverse this matter, is because that acceleration clause is a penalty clause, and it does so, and it's illustrated by this case because we have double recovery. Judge Johnson, you asked a question about...
I'll let you go ahead.
Liquidated damages, and I did have what I thought was the quote, and it's out of Graco, and it talks about that the court will look to not intent, but whether the amount agreed on is reasonable or unreasonable in light of the contract as a whole. I think that goes to your question. Apologize if it does not. One of the other things I'd like to briefly comment on is, obviously there's reference made to sophisticated parties. And I think ultimately, when we look at this case law, I think what they're ultimately arguing is, well, because they're sophisticated, it's okay if they get taken advantage of, but that there should be some sort of analysis for the truly downtrodden where penalty clauses aren't enforceable. I think that misstates Minnesota law. It also makes it utterly unmanageable. I don't think we want to put district courts in deciding whether or not somebody has been, you know, abused in the state of contract.
Mr. Hansen, is there anything in the record about the intent of the parties or their negotiators with respect to this particular clause?
With respect to this particular clause, no. There is some broad discussion about that at the time of the initiation that there was an intent to convert it into a performing arts space, but that none of that testimony, to my recollection, at all tied to this question of acceleration clause. As far as the record shows, it doesn't seem that it was, there's nothing in the record that talks about how we got to this language. I see that my time has expired. I'd ask that you reverse the district court and rule that this is a penalty clause and as a consequence rule in my client's favor. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both parties for your arguments here today. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame. That concludes our calendar for today. We are adjourned.